ones.
We'll just take two of them as if the representative of the people. And we've got some action, which is functional vote. And when we need to be specific, I'll use the specific one that I gave you before, that's the new term. Vote. And then it had this potential. Where B had the mass temper vote. Small one for Lakefield. Big one for Lakefield. I didn't write anything down here. Let's see, make sure I write the same way. Masses. And the cubic term will go in just H. Hold on, G, so it can be. Plus, no, there's a bunch of quarter terms. And basically, it was all possible quarter terms that were even under 800. Each plus the equation algorithm I saw. So it was a G, H, and a sort factorial. That's what we call sort factorial. L to the fourth. That's G, H, L, 4. So I'm going to work out the examples using this thing. And the assumption here was that, there's a 1/2 and fiddle L squared 8. So there's a cubic coupling involving. So the assumption was that little m and little m twiddle are much less than big M. And then, and all the dimensionless things, the G's, something called GH here, so I guess it's a G which G's and G twiddles are less than or the order of one. So we're gonna work perfectly in them. And so that in particular means that this cubic thing, this being less than order one means that whatever this mass is here, it could be, I could call this M twiddle, if you like, and that would be something of the order of big M. So this is an assumption. And that's just because this builds in the hierarchy that this guy looks like this one's going to be. Sure. That'll be the example I'll use. But what I'm telling you is not specific to that example. So if you're interested in calculating pretty much anything, you can calculate it from the correlation functions of those fields. So if we define for any operator, you know, the correlation function 5x1, 5xn, be the, you know, the out vacuum, time over the product. That has this half integral representation, which was the integral over all the fields. So here, I'm thinking that, I guess I can write these hats on the motor operators. Phi hat is supposed to be L hat or U hat for any of the fields involved. And the path integral representation of that was that x1 xn was this path integral EDI action function of these phi's and I guess if I want to normalize it, I have to divide by Mural. That's the five. The other fives. The integral of the cube right here is a functional integral over all configurations pi. So if you calculate those, you have an AM. And then the idea was, the way to calculate those as in one fell swoop was to calculate the generating functional. So if you calculate the EDI W of J, we're defined as the integral of the potential of the action plus a current I times the integral J of X, of X, for X. And by differentiating W repeatedly, you can figure out what all these correlation functions are. What we were interested in particular was the generator of one particle irreducible graphs, gamma phi, which we defined to be W. So in particular, I should say, special case where you have one field here. So phi, which is phi, was just from this thing. If I differentiate this with respect to J once, I get that vector phi on both sides. It's just that. Because when I differentiate this side, I get EDIW times DWJ times I. If I divide by the EDIW, that's this denominator. And what's left here will be at interval of differentiating the J pulled down 5 and the I, and the I is canceled. So that's true. So if I think of this as being phi is functional of J, if I invert, that gives me J with functional of phi in principle. That's the current I would have to turn on to obtain any particular desired field as the expectation value for phi. So I can think of that, think of them interchangeably. And then a useful functional of phi to think about is this Legendre transform of W. So it's thought of as W to the function of J is phi minus the integral of J times phi. And that type of property, that delta gamma delta phi plus j is equal to 0. And so one way to think of this was that, Siri? Yeah?
So phi is the exponential value of phi if j is equal to 0?
Yeah, so yeah, I should rewrite this as being that little j here to. Phi as a functional of j would be the expectation value in the presence of the action with this current in it, right? Okay. And then the next thing I was going to say is what you're saying, right? The system you really were interested in was the system without this current. So I call that, say, phi naught, that would be phi j to 0. That would be really the honest to God, in fact, the expectation value of phi. And strictly speaking, it's the in versus out. So this is the vacuum in the remote past versus the vacuum in the remote future. And normally that doesn't make a difference if you're thinking of a time-dependent independent system, like, you know, flat space or something. But in things like cosmology where you've got a time-dependent background, it's an important distinction between what you start off with as a vacuum and what you end up with in the vacuum because you don't have the same state. That's why the normalization was so important, because if you're in the same state, you could say, this is just always one, it's a normalized state. So you have to be more careful if you're doing this expectation value, thinking of this in-out expectation value as the expectation value in the same state is something which is true for time-independent systems, but not in general. So you have to be careful in different cosmology about doing things a little differently than what I do here. So the point of the exercise was that gamma has several interesting properties. It's called the 1PI generator. Has the property that it's the thing that if you took J equals 0, so you're interested in the real vacuum, then the vacuum configuration, if I got a vacuum configuration for the field, the field operator is the stationary point of this thing with gamma, in the same way that a classical solution was the stationary point of the classical action. And you can do better than that. In an adiabatic sense,
there's really a sense in which gamma, you can interpret gamma as being the minimum energy configuration subject to the constraint that you require the identified in the field to be equal to a specified value, if you're looking at time-independent configurations. So there's a very much a sense in which this is like a potential energy. So, so not always an extremum you're looking for, you look for the minimum of gamma when you calculate the size. So you minimize it to learn what phi is. It also is easy to calculate because it turns out that it's the sum of in a semi-classical expansion, it starts off as being a classical action plus some one loop thing, which I'm going to be more explicit about, sorry, plus some of graphs. So two of graphs and higher, which are one part of your irreducible. That's why it's called the one feedback. And that means graphs that cannot be broken in two by cutting one line. So for example, two loops we have, and they're vacuum graphs. So they have no external lines. So graphs like this, or graphs like this, which are there, but graphs like this are not there, because that one's reducible. So it's a pretty useful thing. It's easy to calculate in perturbation theory. It's got a nice physical interpretation. It's like the quantum, people have called it the effective action in the old days because it was to the quantum theory what the classical action was to the classical theory in some sense. So it's a useful thing to know. Yes.
It's only for the vacuum or for any state that is a stationary quantum state.
The statement is that the
gamma can also have other states that are not the vacuum that are also stationary components of gamma that are basically if you have a background field or something like that.
I'm not sure what you mean there. It's a
So if you have basically macroscopic field configurations that are stationary points of gamma, does that mean that they are like persistent quantum states or something like that? Is that not the vacuum?
The thing is, there's more than one solution or something to the gamma d phi equals zero. Yeah, I think it's the same, very similar story to the classical that there'll be more than one solution to depend on battery. And so, the state you're always getting value in. If you specify what phi is, then what you're calculating here is basically the expectation value of the, you know, the this thing is in some sense the in-out and amplitude in the presence of this current with no operators inserted. And so there's a sense in which this is the vacuum-to-vacuum, TBI gamma is the vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude for the state, which is the ground state, the minimum energy state, given the constraint that the expectation value is fixed. So once you minimize it, you kind of extremize over all states, and that's why you're getting the vacuum expectation value as opposed to some other state. So once you've turned the once you set the current to zero, the thing you're finding when you extremize is really the vacuum amplitude of this. But what the vacuum is depends on things like boundary conditions, the same way the plastic solution and the boundary conditions forces you make, and initial conditions as well. And a caveat to this whole story would be that you shouldn't think, and people often do think, that in the classical theory, what you would have done is if you wanted to know what time evolution, if you solve the classical equation of motion, you figure it out. But if you find the time evolution of this thing, that's not necessarily what the system does. So in the quantum system, when you evolve the system forward, if you're in the adiabatic limit where the time evolution, basically the ground state is a function of time, but it's something which is just parametrically changing, and you're not actually making any transitions between states as time evolves. And in that limit, the field configuration you would have found as a function of time is the right one. But if you were in a situation where you've got you hit the system in a curve with a non-adiabatic perturbation or something which causes you to do transitions among states, and you're not staying in the adiabatic vacuum, and the time evolution you would calculate in the real thing, real problem, is not what you're divided by two less. So the time dependent problem, you have to be careful about thinking of this action, but as long as your native ag limit is max. And the reason that you can see that is that I didn't prove why this is true, but if you kind of go through the argument splice, like an energy state, you see that you make a native ag assumption. So that's just all field theory. And, but if you're focusing on light heavy things, then you know, we can generalize this to, for this particular, if I specialize this particular example, then effective action would have been a function of two things. Two column curly, you know, little door phase LA, where E to the I path integral representation for this thing is the one that you just maybe start off with the occurrence. So for two fields, this is the last thing I'm going to do last time. What we would do is we define E to the IW, and we have a current for each of these fields, given the column, that's integral DH, DL, E to the I, action, and LH, plus the current term where we couple J to couple. And then in the same way, we would find that the what I called curly phi over there, the expectation value, that was W of the current. I'll do that separately for each field now. So here's the expectation value of the light field would be given by this derivative, and the expectation value of the heavy field. And we do the Legendre transform the same way. So we define gamma function of L and H to be W is a function of J of L and H, little j of L and H, minus inequality for X. And then we're off the races. So all the things that go there apply to this. But if we're interested only in observables at low energy, so we have this hierarchy of scales, we only want to follow what happens. So we're going to start off with only light particles, and we're not going to give them enough energy to produce heavy particles. So we're thinking that the whole description of what happens can be described in terms of the light particle field. Those have all the matrix elements on light particle state. It's going to be useful to specialize this to those specific observables. So far, we have any possible correlation function in the whole theory, and it's described by this thing. And with that restriction will come about by restricting ourselves to long wavelength fields here, or long wavelength currents. So what we'll do is that if we ask for...
can you just refresh my memory on why you fix that special or
electromagnetic? It's just an example.
Is
there a reason to be general, but it's not quite perfectly general?
Yeah, there's a cubic term in H, but not in L.
Yeah, the things I did not write are there's no L term, there's no H term, there's no L cube term. And I could have put them in. It's just that I don't know why I didn't put that, I didn't put the L cube term in. These two terms I can always get rid of by shifting L and H, it's just expanding around the minimum. But the L cube term I probably just didn't put in for that product. I'm gonna leave it up because it may be that down the road there's some point that gets simpler. But it's more or less, there's no reason why you could have done anything. Because I want it to be simple enough to be explicit that I can get. I want to calculate gamma, and I want to calculate the thing I'm about to describe, the light particle that are useful explicitly for this theory at the classical and one loop level. So you can explicitly see what the answer is and how it depends on this mass hierarchy, and so you can see what the properties are, both at the classical and one loop level. And then I want to define the Wilson action, which is the thing people you normally use in these calculations. And I'm going to calculate it explicitly in this example and show you how the Wilson action gives you this answers that we know are. So first we're just going to calculate these things just in the full theory, just get what the right answer is. And then I want to define the Wilson action and show you, calculate what it is for this theory, and then calculate these things again using the Wilson action, you'll see why you're getting the same answer as you should be getting. But you'll see why the calculation is being organized in an efficient way. And so it's just really, think of this as just being an example where you can be explicit enough to just do it all and see how it works. And then along the way, there'll be issues that come up that I'll kind of highlight, which will be more general. All right, so last thing I wanted to define before stopping last time was the one light particle reducible generator. So the new word here is light, so it's just following the light freedom. So what we do is we're not interested in following any correlation functions of a heavy field H. So we'll just set its current equal to zero because we want it to be in the vacuum. We're not going to imagine turning on a current to make the H field take any particular value. We'll just let it take its vacuum type. It's going to be its status ticket. So we'll set capital J equal zero. That means we're not going to follow any correlation functions involving H. We'll also ask J to be slowly varying. And what that will mean is we're going to do this in a semi-classical approximation. So let me just skip ahead so that you see where I'm going. So if the action were writable as being the write the S of phi plus some shift of P of phi. As being the background action plus the linear term. I'm writing this kind of schematically here with linear intervals. Phi plus equals S pi squared. So if I do it together 10, then around phi capital, this phi equals zero. Then this operator plays an important role. This, if I wrote this term out in more detail, that thing would have been something like the integral d for x of minus 1 half phi of x, some operator delta acting on phi of x. I actually wrote that out. Second derivative of an action. So first derivative is some local function. Second derivative is something which is local. It's a delta function at the 2 points that you're evaluating this thing at. And then this. What I'm not writing here is a convolution that connects this and this, and that's what this integral was. There's two integrals here, one of which fits on my delta function. So the quadratic part of the action, you can always write as being some operator. And so for example, in this example, delta would be a 2x2 thing involving L and H. And the diagonal pieces would be something like minus box plus M squared. Plus, the other stuff, and there might be some off diagonal things. And the diagonal thing for the heavy W minus plus capital M squared plus. So, this is some operator which you can read off the action, and I'll do it explicitly here, so it won't be some serious thing. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask for slowly varying will be the last. We're going to, what you're doing when you do a Gaussian interval is you're taking the fields as phi. You're writing it as a sum over eigenvalues, eigenfunctions. You're decomposing it in terms of eigenfunctions. You're writing it as some coefficients and some basis functions. This is where these things are chosen so that this operator delta that we're talking about acting on the views is equal to eigenvalue. And so slowly varying will be, we'll ask these eigenvalues to be less than something. That's the thing that's the same as slowly varying. So it's low energy in that sense. Phrasing it this way, this is a way that generalizes to curved space and a lot of examples that are not just flat space. But for flat space,
are you actually going to do such an expansion?
Yeah, in flat space.
Why won't your cubic and such terms screw you over?
Well, they're going to be in this. It's what I'm doing is I'm. In semi-classical expansion, I'm going to have gamma will be the classical action plus this one loop thing plus graphs. And where that came from was if you had an integral d phi, you're trying to evaluate. Remember, the expression I derived before was that d phi turns out to be d phi action of phi plus when you're integrating plus the current phi. So you're evaluating this Gaussian integral. So logic of the semi-classic expansion is that if you just did the standard expansion here, like I was doing over there, so you write this as being integral v-pi of e to the I, classical action, which I can pull out of the integral because it doesn't depend on the integration variable. Then there's a linear term which involves this and the part of the action, this part of the action here, which I'm going to ignore because that's the thing that goes through and makes this into the one part of the irreducible cross product. Then there's a quadratic piece, s prime prime phi squared. And then there's cheaper and higher, but in perturbation theory, the agreement is that what we're going to do is if we're going to be doing this integral, we're going to be dominant.
Oh, yeah, one yeah, sound okay.
So we'll have 1 plus, s prime 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 phi cubed, and so on. So just expansion of the integral, of the exponential. So all the finite graphs are coming from doing this part of it.
Okay.
One looper is coming from just taking the one piece. The classical approximation is not doing the integral at all, starting from that piece, because if I read off, if I take the logarithm, this says that gamma, if I just kept that piece and ignored the integral, that would have not affected the classical action. If I do the Gaussian piece, I'm going to get a new piece, which is the logarithm, because I took the logarithm to get rid of this stuff, of the result here, which could have been a determinant of delta minus half. And if I do if I do these things, I get the graphs that I told you about. So that's this explicit finite rule thing is coming from evaluating these Gaussian integrals as far as
possible. It's not wrong for me to think that ds d phi we're ignoring because it satisfies the classical equations of motion.
It is wrong to think that. It's tempting to think that.
Okay.
So the thing is that the linear piece you're asking about, there was a delta s delta phi.
And that's not so.
There's also a j piece. And what's happening really is that in J, whenever it was minus delta gamma delta phi, so it sounds like it's a circular definition because you're trying to figure out gamma. But the upshot was that, and with the gamma was the classical action plus stuff, so the classical action part here is canceling. But the extra piece is coming from the derivative of gamma with the loop corrections. That's just going through and getting rid of all your one particle reducible graphs.
Okay, so that's what gets rid of.
Okay. So if you actually kept it, you'd have to keep all the graphs, all the connected graphs here. And then this extra thing you're keeping, which then systematically comes through and cancels all the one part reducible ones. But the thesis dies for your sin thing is that you don't have to do that anymore. And you know that the extra is going to be one part reducible graphs, so then you just ignore that because it's doing the job to the point away. Okay. So the logic of this expansion is that for these Gaussian integrals, you basically are diagonalizing the thing in the action. And so once you've written in terms of the eigenfunctions of this operator delta, wherever I wrote it here. We've got a bunch of uncorrelated integrals so that you actually do the, and you derive the kind of rules. In practice, what you're doing is you're using exact functions, so that's a useful way to derive things. And in flat space, these would just be momentum states, right? So delta in that case, for one field, would be minus box plus m squared, let's say. So then the u's would have been labeled by p. It would be e to the I px up to some normalization. And so, the lambdas would have been labeled by p. They would have been p squared plus m squared. So what we'd be asking here for would be to say that p squared m squared is less than lambda squared. So obviously, this has dimensions of m squared. And you can see here that there's a subtlety because in Lorentzian signature, this is really minus energy squared plus 3 minus m squared plus m squared. So this being small doesn't mean that the energy is small, because if your energy is related to your momentum in the way that your dispersion relation normally tells you, this would have been 0. So that's being close to max field. So when you make this statement, what's normally done, if you wanted to phrase the way I'm doing now, this is not going to be important later on, but if you wanted to really press these definitions through, what you do is you'd ask to do this in the Euclidean signature. So you can continue this path integral to Euclidean signature, and all the Feynman rules, all the boundary conditions in the time direction do with the Feynman propagator rather than the retarded one, are easy in that case. That when you go to Euclidean signature, just the unique answer you would have gotten in the Euclidean signature continues to the Feynman conditions. And so in the Euclidean signature, this is now p plus e squared plus p squared. So this is really an upper bound on what momentum and energy could be. So that's the way to think about this if you really want to think of this as discriminating light heavy. Although in practice, we never got a calculate this way. One thing I want you to be aware of is that you see that this condition, if we had taken the heavy mass, so if we're going to choose lambda to be satisfying that it's much, much bigger than the light mass, and much, much smaller than the heavy mass, and we can do that because we know there's an hierarchy between these two things. That's the assumption, right? So we'll choose lambda to be somewhere in there. And when we do that, because lambda is smaller than the heavy mass, for any momentum involving the heavy field, this is always this is never satisfied. Right? Because once the mass is bigger than lambda, it doesn't matter what the momentum is in the Newtonian center. So all momentum modes of the heavy field would be excluded by this condition. Whereas for the light field, where the mass is smaller than lambda, you're including the momenta up to momenta of order lambda. But it's discriminating against high frequency modes of the light field and all the modes of the heavy field. So given that kind of background, what what we want to do is define the generator one particle, one light particle, and I was going to call that a little bit, a function only in the light field. And it would be found, so if I start with the definition of the full generator, that was that integral representation of that was the integral over H. Integral over L and B to the I, classical action is a function of L plus L plus H plus I times the integral of the currents, coupled only with fluctuations of T. So to get the light particle generator, what we're supposed to do is evaluate it capital J equals zero, so that'll kill this term. And it also tells us what setting capital J equals zero is a statement of what little h is. So we're going to evaluate capital J equals zero and J equals a long wavelength. So all the Fourier components of J which involve momenta such that they're high frequency in the sense of spider there are set to zero. And what we're going to get is what we're calling Lebel. So that'll be the integral dH dL string dH dL dI action L now H. You should think of this is no longer a free variable because of this choice J equals zero. So J equals zero means that the gamma dH, that plus J is always equal to zero. And so if J is zero, we're asking that H be a stationary point of gamma. So let's say that that is, let's call that H bar. That'll be a function of the other variable here. This is a function of L and H. So there'll be an H bar as a function of L, which is the solution to this equation that J is equal to zero. And we're supposed to take the same and evaluate H at that point. So it's H bar of L plus H plus I integral of press J and so on.
Let's assume that H is big H.
This is saying that the logic of these currents is that when you turn the current on, you're just adding some sort of a piece to the action. But when you're thinking of the variables that you're choosing as being L and H, what you're thinking is that if I turn the current on, I get an excitation value for the field, which depends on the current. Or I'm thinking of it now the other way around, that if you gave me a field that you wanted to have, I'm finding the current I need to get that field. And so this is saying that but if I didn't turn the current on at all, then I got the vacuum of the system, the real system. So this is saying that the H field is actually choosing its excitation value that would have had in its vacuum, as opposed to some artificial thing you've got for turning the current on. And the answer you get will depend on L, because we're turning current on to a range for the excitation value for L to be some specified function. And when we do that, that's going to make the H system respond to that. So it's going to have an anticipation. The answer you're going to get for H will depend on what you did for L, because of that. So this is the thing that has all the information that you would, if you weren't, if you're already calculating correlation functions of light fields at low energies, then anything you want to calculate is in this. And this is just carrying around too much information because it's carrying around the heavy field too, which you're never going to measure low energy. So far all it is it's a specialization, it's a restriction in the kinds of things you're asking about the theory. There's no difference between these two things. And the thing important in practice was that this is the difference between when you're calculating it, this is the sum of all the one particle irreducible graphs. But this is the sum of one particle, this includes one particle reducible graphs, provided the graph that the line that you cut to reduce it is a heavy particle. Because the thing that made the sum of the graphs here one particle irreducible was the presence of this current. But we turned the current off for the heavy fields. So that means that you're no longer having a single through and lop off all the one particle reducible graphs for the heavy fields. You're still going into the light field because you kept its current. But you're not going into the heavy field. So you can sometimes if you're thinking of calculating the one particle irreducible action, and you've got a real theory, you're calculating what the low energy limit would be, you sometimes exclude tree graphs which involve the change of heavy states, thinking, well, I'm calculating something which is one part irreducible, why should I be including the exchange of heavy states? And that's the wrong thing to do if you're only working at low energies. And in particular, if you're working in supersymmetric theories, there's non-renormalization theorems which say that if you calculate the superpotential for this kind of a thing, it typically doesn't get any corrections at all from loops. And so you could be led to believe that when I integrate out a heavy particle to get out of the work of low energies, I will never change the superpotential. But you can, because one particle reducible graphs can change the superpotential. So there's paradox that you can run into if you're not careful with thinking about what the graphs are. Alright, so let me just, for this example, calculate. So the first step, so let's, in the Poisson theory, which is that one up there, what we'll do is we'll calculate gamma and gamma between the one loop level. And at one loop, we'll only do the lowest in the derivative expansion. So the classical level, tree is classical. So if in this expansion here in this pathological representation, I wrote gamma is a classical axis plus something at one loop plus one graph. First thing to do is keep that term. That's a classical approximation. If you had been doing graphs, that would have been the tree graph thing. So in the point example I started the class with, I did tree graphs. The answers I would have gotten in that theory are, in the way I'm doing now, would have come by taking gamma and saying it's a classical action. That's why you use tree and classical interchangeably. You follow the H bars in the loop expansion, you see that H bar counts loops. All right, so the linear approximation. Classical. We know that gamma is a function of L and H. It's just the classical action of L and H. So that's this thing over there. But what's the little gamma? Well, that's supposed to be the classical action. It's a complete gamma. So like I said, I could have written this as e to the I. The full action is a function of L and H bar, which is a function of L. Well, one way of writing this answer was, what happened when we did this path integral? The graphs we did were different, but another way of saying it was that if you calculated the full answer, if you knew already what the full answer was for the whole one part of the reducible piece, specializing to j equals 0 is the same thing as specializing h to its factor value. So in the classical approximation, what we know is that gamma is the classical action of that is. And what we're supposed to do to get this one light particle irreducible thing at tree level is the specialized hit to the back end value for H, where that's defined at the classical approximation. So where the classical action in the H evaluated H bar is equal to 0. So what I'm supposed to do for the leading approximation to get this one light particle reducible generator is take the classical action for the string theory, take all the heavy fields and just eliminate them using their equation. And that, if you had done the graphical calculation of this path interval, would have been take all the tree graphs with external lines of all the light fields. And this is much easier way to think about it. Okay, so let's do that. So the equation of motion for H for that action, let me pull the action down again, is so if I vary H, the classical term gives me there's a box H, so the one right here is delta action delta H. That's box H. Okay, plus box H, the two went away because I had to vary two H's here. Okay, plus box H minus B prime of H. So I got let me write the minus over there. I'll lose my sign when I do it. Okay. So I'm going to have m squared h plus g squared h m over 2 factorial h squared plus g h over 3 factorial h cubed and nothing. And then plus G L H over 2 plus for H. And then the last one is plus M plus 1/2 M quill 2 L squared. That's supposed to be 0. That's what defines H bar. So if I take the pieces here that are linear in H, that's minus box plus m squared plus g of h over 2 l squared on h bar. Put the rest of it on the right hand side, then I would add a minus integral over 2 l squared, that one. So what I do is I want to solve this perturbatively in these couplings of g's. And so you see that if I didn't have these terms, we could basically solve everything because if we can invert this operator, then this is a source term which is the value of h. And this is showing you that the value of h is going to depend on L because this particular term is acting like a source term for h. That's why I put it in. It's the thing that was one of the ones that was cubic. So, you know, if I put it in theory, you have to put it in candidate. And these things are going to complicate things, but again, the logic will be for doing perturbation theory in G is that we can first solve the equation with G zero, we'll find what H is, and then we can plug it in here and iteratively take a solution. So plugging H in here will be an answer, and then you know, if I write H as a series in G, if I iteratively start with a zero for a solution in here, and it's going to change the solution I'm going to plug in this, and then I can bootstrap my way up and get a series expansion for H. But I'm not going to worry about these guys. I'm going to just write plus quarter g. And I want to follow what happens to these guys because the inverting of this thing is the thing that looks hard. But it becomes easy when this m is large. So the formal solution here would have been h bar of l would have been the inverse operator of this thing. So minus cos plus m squared plus 1/2 g l h l squared inverse minus m squared over 2 L squared. And 1 plus quarter g to h. So that would be all the iterative stuff.
In the second class line, I think you're missing a factor of big M where you have the gh tilde h squared. So multiply by big M.
Right. So this looks hard. It's not so hard in flat space, and if L had been small, if L is a constant, then it's like just the usual propagator would have been 1 over p squared plus m squared. But the m would depend on the value of L. In position space, if you're working in a, you know, some non-flat background or working in the presence of electromagnetic fields or something else, you can do this in position space too. Because what I'm really interested in is the large m limit. So when m is large, you're being dominated by this term, and then that's just a number, so inverting that's easy. And the perturbations around that are going to be this and this, because the value of L can't be too large without having the potential energy become large. If I can't choosing the energy to be small compared to the scale lambda, which is my distinction between, I didn't just choose capital J to zero, I chose the current for the light field to have only support in long wavelengths. And that means that's a restriction on L, and that restriction is basically saying that the energy associated with the configuration L can't be too large. And in the potential energy here, if I let little L be too big, then I start getting a lot of energy. So there's implicitly a restriction on how big little L can be from this low energy condition. And so I'm free to think of both this term here, because it depends on L, and this term here because it depends on lambda, which is the eigenvalue, to be small compared to capital M. And so when I invert this, what I'll do is I'll keep this as the first term and I'll keep these as the perturbations. So that's the, you need that position space to do with the position space. So I want to keep that. So the solution here is going to be, so what we'll do is we'll say that what I'm saying is m squared minus box plus whatever the other thing was, 1/2 pH, you know, h, l squared. That's approximately equal to m to the minus 2, 1 minus box over m squared plus g l h l squared over m squared. And that's that. One, so the first term here would have been plus box over m squared minus ELH m squared. Let me figure out what the next one is, but I want to be real time to look at it wrong, so I'll just type that. So the next term here would have been the answer to order 1 over m to the 4th is actually one here, because this one just came in the 4th. So h bar from L, if I plug this into that, it's going to be, the 1 just gives me the minus m little squared over 2 capital M squared L squared. Something wrong with that dimension. So I have to use that term now, and now to use these terms, I get plus GLH in total over 4 m to the 4th, m to the 4th, plus m. And I've got the next term is minus m total over 2 m to the 4th. Box L squared. That's where it went. And plus square G H and G to H. So these are the leading things you look at. So this is everything if you're working to zero order in these self couplings of the heavy field. And you're working to order 1 over m to the 5th. 1 over m to the 4th are smaller. That's a possible approximation, then this is the whole answer. So what I'm supposed to do now is I'm supposed to take that, plug it into the class line, because that's what that's what we analyze. So I'm going to do that. So gamma is a function of L, which is classical action of the approximation. So this is like, this is a tree level approximation for a purpose of T. As class action of function of L, evaluated as the heavy field at the solution. So for the order we're working, it's the thing that involves no inverse power of this. You know, everything here involves an inverse power of m in H. And so the first term would have been basically the classical action when H is equal to zero. So there's that's integral of d4x. I guess another overall x minus 1/2 dl. So I'm looking at all the terms here that have no h. So there's a kinetic term, and there's this quarter term. That's it. Turn the end of mass. So this is the order 1 over n to the 0 term. And the next term is this 1 over m squared piece, which is plus d4x m squared over 8 m squared over 4. This is the order of 1 over m squared. And if I just write up what box of L squared is, it's a constant of D L. And then it's DLH equal square 16.4. So this is everything classical approximation. Neglecting powers of the cell coupling of Higgs and working to this order in one of the.
Why is box L squared 4 order in one? Like L squared CLP?
Oh, there isn't around there. Oh, wait, because the thing is that H is appearing in the action. So H appears, like, for instance, in this cubic piece, there's an L squared H piece. So if I take that times the bottom L squared, that's what it's supposed to have. I think I designed this so it's invariant for L just minus L. So remember, you had anything that's no cutoff for us at L.
So that's why you left the L cube thing.
Yeah, that's probably why the L cube's not there. Yeah. Right, so that was hard. And there's a couple things about that I want to say. It's really worth doing this calculation. So you guys should all do this calculation at home because there's several things I want you to see that are. Some things happen here that are not, most things that happen here are generic, and I put enough terms in to have it happen. There's a couple things that are not generic, which keep giving me some to loop the operation to see why. There were a couple steps that happened in there that are worth proving here explicitly. So the points are, so one thing is, I'm giving you the points notice. So one is that the obvious thing is that all the things that came, the first term we had was just the leading approximation. Just to set h prime to zero, right? All the in the expression for h, every term here was explicitly suppressed by powers of 1 over m squared. What made this really practical under integrating this thing was the large m expansion, and everybody was down by 1 over m. So in this example, you know, gamma at tree level, when n goes to infinity, would have just turned out to be awesome action. As much a light field, and with a heavy field value of zero. And that's not generic. That's something which, that relies on several things. So one thing is, there's two, in particular, there's two things it relies on. One of them is, this is only suppressed by the heavy mass if we, because we're assuming, why is that not true? So maybe only one thing here. Even if m little is, the reason that it would happen that the answer here was given by h equals 0 was we chose m twiddle to be small compared to m. If m twiddle had been order m, it looks like this is still suppressed, right? It's still true that this is done like 1 over m. This is 1 over m squared. So h bar looks like it's going to 0. So that looks like, that would lead you to think that because h bar is always going to 0 when m is large, it has to be true that the classical action is given by evaluating the classical field as 0. But the reason that's wrong is that you have positive powers of m in the action. And so if h is of order 1 over m, as it would be if this was order m, then this survives the limit that m gets large. So h has to be falling faster than 1 over m to have this term turn off when you go to the large m limit. So this feature that the result was the result that you get by truncating the heavy field to 0 is often true, but not always true. And in particular, in supersymmetric theories, it's rarely true, in the sense that because the bosons and the fermions come together, if you did the same exercise in a supersymmetric theory, global symmetry, which you should all do, because it's really instructive, you'll see that the analog of the statement I'm telling you, what you might have thought is the statement that you should be using in a supersymmetric theory is that you just do these definitions, and that's true, but that's the same thing, it turns out, as taking the superpotential and evaluating it at zero field rather than taking the action. And, if you take the action and evaluate it at the classical solution, you get the right answer. But what it's the same as is just taking the superpotential and evaluating it at the field equals zero. It's not the same as taking the classical action and evaluating it at the heavy field equals zero, as we've done here. Because of the same thing like this, in the supersymmetric case, you don't have the freedom to choose these two things differently. And so you're being tied, this is being tied to be large if that's large, often. And so that's a dangerous thing that you can get burned on if you're not careful. So the truncation, this is often called, so this here is called the truncation approximation. If you're doing close applying theories where the heavy theory is the extra dimensional stuff and the light theory is the four dimensional stuff, that's very often what you do is if you truncate and the light degrees of freedom are the ones that don't depend on the extra dimensions. The logic of what you're doing is this. And there are cases when it doesn't happen, when that's the wrong answer. And it tends to be cases where the fields, the heavy fields, these occlusive fine fields, are not being turned off quickly enough as the mass gets large in the same way as would have happened here if this had been done using the same order. So just be aware that there's an assumption that the truncation approximation need not be the leading low energy limit, but it very often is. So people are in the habit of using it because it very often is, but you should be aware that you have to check something. So make sure this is true. On my list here, I have what's called decoupling, so it's kind of a. So I should write here, this need not obvious. In our case, in particular, in this case, it assumes, you might have asked, why did it have to assume M twiddle would be small for capital M? And this is part of the story that second decoupling story is that, so regardless of what H does, here you see that all the contributions to the action that came from H are suppressed by M. So they would all turn off if M went to infinity. So as M, as little m over big M goes to zero, all heavy stuff drops out. So that's related to this first statement that the effects of the heavy particle, or the effects of the difference between having zero here and having h bar here, were all down by 1 over m. That's saying that the first approximation, the heavy fields aren't in your problem. So if you're, so if you wanted to understand things at low energies, a leading approximation very often is just ignore the heavy particles. But you're going to see that this is also not always true. In particular, at one loop, as soon as you do the quantum corrections, this is very rarely true.
So this is an accident of classical approximation.
There's still a coupling statement. The coupling statement is not that as m goes to m, all the interaction terms drop away. For as big m goes to infinity, that all the interaction terms come above the heavy field turn on. When you include loops, what will happen is that the loops of the heavy fields can change the coefficients of the terms you already have. So you get contributions like this one. So if m twiddle had been not small compared to m, we would have got a contribution here, which was not expressed by m, which is like one of the terms we already have in the action. So the statement generically is that it's not that the new physics effects go to zero, but that there exists a renormalization scheme. So you can choose these couplings of the part of the action that involves light fields in such a way that once you make the right choice, the heavy particles drop out of everything and get like one power. But it may be that if you do a calculation, you're not in that renormalization scheme. So there'll be things that look like they're not small, but they can all be removed by doing a smart choice of normalization. So when I do the loops, that'll be more explicit. But be aware that the statement that heavy effects are all going to one random is an excellent classical approximation. And the third thing I wanted to say was it's local, but I've said that before, that the locality of the thing came. Because of the large n expansion and the Green's functions were all turned into power of the box, and we stopped. We never went to arbitrarily high powers. Only after stopping the Werner Hamsburg expansion. Some fixed order. If you went to all orders of one gram squared, then this propagator really is some non-local Green's function that tops different points in space talk to each other. It's only the fixed power in one gram squared that's creating local effects. The last thing was it looks like there's a derivative interaction here. So it looks like what we got was a piece of potential, another piece of potential. So we got a correction to the potential we already had. So this is like a change to G right. We got an L with 6 term that we didn't have before, but which is now an incoming potential. It looks like there's no interactions here which depend on the derivatives of L. And that's deceptive because some of these interactions are not all dependent on one another. So if you were to calculate the scattering rate for light particles, like I did for the twin model at the very beginning of class, with this Lagrangian, what you'd find is that these coefficients here, if you call this coefficient A, some B, and some C, you'd find that they were not appearing independently. If you calculate all possible scattering amplitudes, you'd find that those three independent coefficients, A, B, and C, they're always appearing in two independent combinations, no matter what you calculate. So if you were trying to do scattering of light particles to infer the values of these constants here, you would be always thwarted because there would be one combination you can never eliminate. You never get the three independent things in your answer. And that's because they're not all independent. So this redundancy, only two of these order 1 over n to the fourth of m squared interactions are independent. And that's because we can do a field redefinition to make one of them look like the other two. I can turn the L squared, the L term
combination of L to the 4th and L to the 6th. Well, you can look at the other way around. There's nothing special about which two you choose. There's only two of them, right? So let me show you how that argument goes. So the idea is this, supposing you have an action which is given to you as a series in some small thing. In our case, it's 1 over m squared, but the argument of making it more general than that. So we have an action which is in some field, and it's some zeroth order thing plus epsilon times some first order thing. So where epsilon is small, whatever it is. And the claim is, let me make an argument for this first order thing, but you'll see that it's by induction you can do it for any order. And so for first order, the statement is that I'm always free to simplify. That's for me, I'm not busy. I'm always free to simplify this thing using the equation of motion of this thing by doing the field. So the claim is, I'm always simplify as 1 of pi using pi as 0. So why is that? So the idea is that so consider the following equipment. We'll take phi, and we'll redefine it to phi goes to phi plus epsilon times something. Let me call it c. I want to find x c, which will allow me to set to zero anything in s1 that is proportional to the field equations. I choose c to ensure any term in S1 of the form epsilon as a rectangle delta S times some coefficient. This can have an X and X for X. So the claim is I can always find X C. Such that if you had a term in S1 which was proportional to the equation of motion, so it vanishes when the equation of motion is true, the lowest order equation of motion, I can always find xc such that this is zero. I can remove this by doing these two. And another way of saying that is that if someone hands you S1, you're free to use the field equation system. Because you can, if I can trade box L for powers of L, field equation, and I can write the difference between box L and R of L as something which vanishes like this. So what you can see where I'm going now, that if you do this for the change of variables, so if phi is equal to phi plus epsilon times c. But if I evaluate the action, so the action is a functional of phi, becomes, so that was originally, S naught was a functional of phi. So what I'm going to do is I can say, let me call this psi as a new variable. So if I did this change of variables and I worked to linear order in epsilon still, then this would have been S naught of psi, plus the first term from the expansion here, which would have been plus an integral d4x epsilon times c of x times delta epsilon x. That's the change of variables of this thing, the first order in epsilon. Then there's an order in epsilon squared things. So I'm just here expanding this thing when I plug in this. But then to order epsilon, I'm not supposed to shift things because this already has an epsilon, so I should just write epsilon s1 psi And then over that order, epsilon squared is twice.
And so you can see that if I have a term in here, supposing this includes a piece which is epsilon integral v4x, some coefficient of x, times delta s naught, delta 5x, and all I have to do is I have to just c to be minus c in other business, right? So what I do is I choose c equals minus c, cancel integral of c delta s naught. From this one. So the upshot is that I'm free to take these things we found, these three terms, and use the L equation of motion that I would have gotten from the leading contribution. The leading contribution is this thing, right? It's just the thing involving L only. So in the gap that we're talking about, I can simplify the equation of motion using box L is equal to something. So in our case, we can use box L. So this is this we're running here is delta minus delta S naught delta L 0, and that's that. So in particular, we have, I can write this one. The integral v4x of L squared d mu L is, if I integrate this, of course, I can put the derivative on the box. Right? I can put the derivative on L, so I can write that as a total derivative. So the integrative of parts, the derivative on that one is the left way to put down, and the next one will be the thing about the process. So now, if you're doing a problem which doesn't care about the boundary conditions, so if you're asking a question which is not topological, or you're asking, if you're just working in perturbation theory and looking at Feynman graphs, say, surface terms you can drop. So this is often something you can ignore. And the often caveat is, if you're interested in boundaries, if you're talking the Casimir effect or something, then you have to be careful because there's actually a boundary in your problem that you're trying to follow. Or if you're calculating instantons where your configurations have topologically non-trivial configurations, and so even though things look like they're total derivatives, they can evaluate to integers that are non-zero. There are cases when this is not the truth that you can drop this thing. But if you're just doing scattering, for instance, that's something. Local perturbations around some localized region of space typically won't care about the boundary conditions. So there's very many applications where you can ignore surface terms. So you can feel free to integrate your parts. And one of them is calculating scattering processes. If you'd used a term like this when calculating the scattering of light particles, you should do it because it's worthwhile. It's an exercise in the Feynman rules. If you just take the Feynman rules for this thing and you ask what's the amplitude I would get for the scattering of light particles, you'll see that it's zero because it's proportional to the sum of the four momenta which have to be vanishing because of momentum conservation. So things like this always drop out of S matrix elements, but sometimes other more general things. So you can kind of see where I'm going now, that between integration by parts and this equality, which allows me to change this, I can rewrite. This is the same thing as we have on this side. So if I just put that on the left-hand side, all that I'll have is 3 times the integral d4x, L squared d mu L, is equal to the surface term, which I can often ignore, and that's this thing. And I have this thing, which is minus integral d4x of L cubed dot L. But if I'm free to also use the equation to most simplify things, I can trade box L for this. So I write this as being a surface term minus, so minus integral for x. So I multiply that by L cubed, so I'll have m squared over 4 plus number 3 factorial GL. So if I use this, so if I divide by 3, so if I use this here, you can see that I can take this coefficient and I can redistribute this being a linear combination of two of the other ones that are there already. So the upshot is an equivalent way to write this would have been, I could have written gamma Q level L with the classical action 8-0. I need to only write two of these charts for it, correctly. So these extra terms that are not over there, these coefficients are the ones that came from using this identity on this particular term. So this particular theory, the statement is that if you want to calculate to order 1 over n to the 4th and the classical approximation, everything in the heavy theories, all of the implications for light physics of the heavy particles, the answer is really simple. One is that you have to shift the value of the Copeland constant you thought you knew, which is irrelevant. If you didn't know what that constant was, the L to the fourth interaction, if you had some unknown coefficient there anyway, it just says that the value you thought you had is a different combination of what you didn't understand anyway. So it's just something that you can't tell the difference between a normalization and a coupling you had already. And the tool effect to order one around the fourth is this L to the sixth interaction. So now if you go out and calculate scattering, or you calculate bound states, or calculate whatever you like, everything is in this interaction. And so knowing this interaction tells you, knowing that this is the only thing that arises in order one around the fourth, it's very powerful to you. It now tells you, choose your favorite observable. You're always talking about this one. So it's a very simple way to, if you know already whatever you want to work in order one around, it's a very simple way to see. Anybody do that? That's kind of the end of the classical example. Now, let me give you the one loop thing. Let me give you that first. So I want to show you how that changes at one loop. So let's do that. Here, I tell you the one loop answer, and I'll make it plausible, but don't, if you haven't seen it before, don't worry about it. You know, if you want more details, I'll tell you the details. So in general, for the one loop calculation, remember, morally, what we're doing is we're taking e to the I gamma of phi, and we've got an action which is e to the I SFI, if I write the, what I'm doing is I'm expanding, I'm starting from that, the basic definition, path integral of state of gamma. So it's a class of life, I'm expanding around the given background. The current couple to that, fluctuation in the background. And I'm writing the classical action is a Taylor expansion in powers of phi. So if I write it schematically as being S of phi plus S prime of phi plus phi plus S prime prime of phi over 2 phi squared plus 1 3 factorial S prime 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 phi cube. I imagine doing a Taylor expansion of the action in a schematic way there. So you each of these things involves integrals, which I'm not writing. Then this becomes EDI so there's a linear piece here, which is S prime A, and then a quadratic piece, which is I Q prime prime. And then all these interactions, the cubic and higher stuff I'm going to write as a write the exponential is 1 plus, let's do the Taylor expansion integrand. Plus, you know, I have 1 half the same thing squared. And so, so the tree approximation, the classic approximation, we kept this only and we ignored the integral. The one approximation is we're going to keep just this stuff, the stuff in the integrand and what I kept in the exponent. So we're going to keep the 1 and we're going to ignore all this stuff. The loops, the various 2 loop graphs and higher would be keeping these things, where each of these things would be a vertex. So something 5 cubed would be a vertex with 3 things. So for example, if I took this term once, this climbing graph here is what I'd like to do, but I can't draw a graph. There's only 1. There's no way to make a backing graph of this. So there's nothing with this one of these things. But if I look at this thing squared from here, then there's something like this, where I have 2 of these interactions. And I would have kept that one, except that I know that the current here goes through and cancels out because it's 1 harder to reduce. If I look at the S to the 4th term here, that would be a vertex like this, and I could have, with 1 insertion of that, made something like that. So that would be how to reduce from here. And so on, because all these 2 loops and higher graphs are coming from this stuff. And so what I want to focus on now is what happens when you just do the Gaussian integral. Now, to the 1 loop approximation, what you said, Bill, was true. One loop approximation, I can specialize the current to the classical approximation because I'm calculating this is the one loop answer. So in that case, J is canceling S prime. And so I don't have to worry about these issues of reducible graphs a lot. And to the one loop approximation, I just have to calculate the Gaussian integral e to the p phi of this quadratic thing. And so that's the thing I want to write down. So. And there's very useful, explicit ways to write this, particularly if you're interested in background field techniques. I'm going to write down the flat space answer, but there's other zeta function ways. There's a several standard tricks making ways to write this one loop answer, which are useful to do, which I admit make me that's a little more exercise. So, anyway, what we want to do is we want to evaluate the one loop. Planning will be, so if I write out now more carefully, so it's just 1 half s prime prime phi squared. What does that mean? That means 1 half the integral d4x d4y of phi of x. Second derivative of that. Phi of x. Y. And this thing we've seen. In the particular case we're looking at now, let me call this. This is what I've been calling delta. So in our example, delta is minus box plus second derivative of potential expected L. Does not matter, but it's the secondary potential affected L of H. the. So that's what we would explicitly have. Or this is the, I'm writing, this is the L contribution, this is the H. So I'm writing here phi is the column vector L H. So if I take that potential that I wrote down before, right, so again, this is the box. So that's explicitly the operator we're talking about. So in terms of delta, what we're supposed to do, we're supposed to calculate this is where those eigenfunctions come in. So if you can find UL of X that satisfies that delta UL of X is equal to some eigenvalue, then this functional integral d phi, you can write that as being the product. So any phi I can then expand as the sum over L of some coefficients, CL, and if I do that, then box phi box phi integral d4x becomes simple. It becomes just the sum over L of CL squared times lambda L, which is the point of the exercise. And so we've got nothing which mixes an L with an L prime. Because what I'm using is that these U's are orthogonal. The integral d for x of u, L, u, L prime. I mean, it's probably about how this time to be here.
Couldn't we just find the inverse of this?
We can, but the integral, what we're going is that the answer for this functional integral is going to be the log of the derivative of this thing.
Oh, so you want to be able to get it easily?
Well, yeah, so you calculate the inverse, but then you still have to do the log of the derivative of the inverse. So that's I think we're going to do that. So that means that the integral we're doing here, so the integral, what we want to calculate is integral d phi of e to the pi over 2, basically with the integral phi del phi. That's just part of this. The integral, one way of integrating over all possible phi's is to integrate over all possible c's. So I can write that as the product over L, d c's of L, of e to the I over 2, sum over L, lambda L, CL squared. And you can see that this is a product of Gaussian integrals now. So this is just product over L of the integral dc of e to the minus e to the I over 2, lambda L, C squared. And so this is a one-dimensional integral, so you can normally do it. What we'll do is we'll use that integral c of e to the I over 2 lambda c squared is equal to constant, which is independent of L, times divided by the square root of lambda. This integral actually ordered in line infinity. And one required lines is that the you can't do this because phase doesn't work, supposed to be done in the Euclidean structure with the minus sign here. And there's an issue there, but in this particular case, that's a wrong statement is that this integral doesn't invert. This integral you can do right here. And the way to see that is that if you take x to be c squared, and dx to be 2c dc, so that means that dc is dx over 2c and c is root x. And that root x is what does it for you, because then this integral would be the integral of dx over 2 root x of e to the I over 2 lambda x. And that is absolutely convergent because of the 1 over root x. It's not absolute convergent, it's convergent. And the way you integrate that is that you rotate the contour, so you're integrating from along the real axis, but if you rotate to 90 degrees, then you can make this thing. I go back to the original C variables, if I integrate and I rotate 390 degrees, I can make this into an integral which is convergent, which is has the sign that you want, it's just a sign here. And because of this root x here, you can see that the contribution from the arc at infinity is zero. And you might have thought that wasn't true because it looks like this thing is a pure phase for any value of c. And so this integral actually can be valued in a meter, and instead of phase, you divide pi by 4, and there's the factors of 2 pi over the square root of 2 pi over the term we get. And I'm going to just ignore everything that's not depending on lambda because we're going to be interested in things depending on fields over there and the numerical coefficient in these integrals. He's going to turn into an additive constant in the gamma, which we're not going to follow because we're interested in the field. But the issue, so you might say, so what's the big deal with Euclidean time integrals? The problem is that if you do multiple integrals, so if you did two of these integrals, say, so you did the integral dx dy being the I over 2 lambda x squared plus y squared, there's two ways you could have imagined doing this integral. One of them would have been, you could think it's what should be the integral dx of e to the I over 2 lambda x squared. The other way would be to do it as an area integral, is to say that, well, take r is equal to r squared is x squared plus y squared. And this should have been 2 pi times the integral dr of r e to the I over 2 lambda r squared. So these would normally agree with each other. But the proof that they agree with each other relies on the integral being absolutely convergent. So in this case, they don't agree with each other. This integral, because this integral exists, the square is also exists. But this integral doesn't make them converge anymore because of the R. So these are not equal to each other. And so there's a prescription that means when you have a phase here rather than a sign, this has been a sign minus lambda, then there would be no ambiguity here, and these integrals all be the same. So the statement is not this integral is poorly posed. It's that many of these integrals are poorly posed. Of course, you're doing many of these integrals. And so if your prescription is that you're going to define this integral to be this one, main power is this one, that's the right answer. That's the definition that you're making of this integral in the Minkowski signature of either phase here. And that's equivalent to what you would do if you had thought to be putting. But there are sometimes problems with what you're putting sign. Gravity figure because some of the you often get plus c squared rather than minus c squared. Those are a problem. So that was that. So bottom line is that we're using this integral many times over. So if we do that over there, we're going to get that the integral d phi, like e to the I over 2 integral phi del phi, that's going to be the product of L integral c of e to the I over 2 integral L c squared. That'll be using this, be some constant, some number, times the product over L of 1 over the square root of L times L. So the product of the eigenvalues, if these lambdas were the eigenvalues of a matrix like delta, so this is commonly written as being 1 over the square root of the determinant of L, because what that means is if you find the eigenvalues of L, multiply them all together, and being spirit. So when I was writing the one lift contribution, I wrote a determinant of delta to the minus 1/2 And that's where it's coming from, is this is state of what the cosine would be. So the trick is, of course, to define what this product means. That's the story itself. So I want to keep that. Okay, so
just you use aspirin.
You mean the Feynman? You mean the width rotation?
That's my
Well, what I would say there, that's one way of arguing it. The way I would argue it is that in the functional integral, when you're in the vacuum, the path integral between two fields is the path integral of configurations whose values at the initial final time are these fields. When you do the vacuum amplitude, what you want to do is you want to multiply by the wave functional, the vacuum in the future, and then the past. And then here over 5. And then you're over all values of 5. And these wave functionals are Gaussians, and they become the I epsilons you're talking about. And so there's a logical distinction that I'd make between the epsilon. If you say the I epsilons are there to regularize or make your integral well defined, I think that's misleading, because if you had asked a different, in principle, you could ask for a different major problem here. And you have different fields, different wave functionals here, and the I epsilon prescription in principle could have changed. And so the way I would phrase it is that the I epsilon prescriptions are coming from the statement that you're using the vacuum as the initial final state. And then because of the I epsilon prescription, you're free to rotate to the Euclidean direction because the poles are in the right place. And then that's the thing that makes these integrals, but that's one way to make these integrals be scaled. But I don't want to phrase the logic that's why you did the I epsilon prescription, because then it would sound like if you did something different, you have to still be doing that same prescription. Because you're making convergence. Whereas the convergence issue here is more of a, the phase is really not the key thing in making this. It's ill-definedness in these multiple integrals, but it's not basic integral you're doing in 1 minute, it's not ill-defined. So what we want to do here is do this, and we'll do it in flat space. And in flat space, we knew that delta was that the box basically flat space. So the box was minus p squared, and these u's were dji dx. And so then all these are just becoming numbers. So now it's a 2-by-2 matrix. We diagonalize the position part of this matrix down. So del in the momentum space, p q would just be delta of p minus q times that matrix over there with p squared. So it's p squared plus b l b l h squared. So now we're just asking for the determinant of this thing will be the product of the determinant of this 2-by-2 matrix times the lambda p in this case would be w lambda p plus or minus, where the plus or minus correspond to the two eigenvectors, two eigenvalues of this. Let's say that this matrix has eigenvalues p plus or minus p. For every p, we've got two eigenvalues, but we have one for each p as well. So then the product over all the eigenvalues, so what I would call the determinant of del, is going to be, in this case, the product over all p, and plus or minus, p plus p, p minus p. So I'm not going to do that product, because if you think back to what gamma was, this is an integral, but we're trying to calculate gamma, and e to the gamma is e to the I s times this integral. So what we want to do is take a logarithm of everything to get gamma. So what will happen is that gamma is going to be s. Now the contribution to this integral now will be, if this integral was 1 over the square root of the determinant, we're going to take the logarithm. So we have have, and we have to multiply by minus I. So it'd be minus I times the logarithm of 1 over the square root of the determinant delta. Would be yes. So the logarithm of anything to a power is to the minus of half three plus I over 2 times the logarithm of the determinant delta. Let me write that as log, capital log, and capital determinant to emphasize that this is an operator reduction, not a meter. So rather than calculate the determinant, what I want to do is calculate this thing. And so the simplest thing to do that is to keep this. So what we want to do is use the log. We want the log times the determinant of L. That's the same thing as the trace log of del. There's a variety of ways to think of that. The simplest one is that if you imagine you can diagonalize del, you have lambda 1, lambda n, so on, then that's what del is. And the determinant of del would be the product of all those eigenvalues. And the log of the determinant of del would be the log of a product, which is the sum. That's the log product. That's the log of the product is the sum of the logs. But that's the sum of, if I taken the trace of del, I would have had the sum over all the eigenvalues. The sum of something is the trace.
Because it's a constant up here, because it doesn't depend on anything. There's lots and lots of things like that same here when I'm done here. So the important thing is that we're always interested not in this, but we're interested in differentiating it with the fields. So as long as you're following the fields, most of these constants that we're talking about that are fully defined are not relevant to what you're trying to calculate anyway. So it's all an additive constant in gamma. So that's why you can relate with this. So you can do this partly because obviously, this is the key formula I want. So what I want to write here is that gamma one of them inactive evaluates for you is I over 2 integral e 4 p 2 times 4 of log of e plus log e minus. And I can tell you what e plus means. Plus and minus p brings the p squared. The key thing is that the momentum is appearing here. Next, I check the board. Momentum appears is important to the unit. So any diagonalization I do make the these terms diagonalized doesn't touch the p squared. So I'm going to p is going to be p squared plus something. So this is plus what I call v plus or minus. Where v plus or minus is equal to 1/2 BLL BH plus or minus square root BLL minus B. Where plus 4 BLA. And since I got this problem, let me just tell you the answer to that integral. So the
we have to evaluate integral d four phi, 2π/4, and the log d squared plus something squared, or d squared. That's going to be one. And that integral diverges. If you think of the angular, if you think of the angular part of the integral, it's just a factor of volume of a three sphere. Because there were four dimensions. We went to Euclidean signature, there'd be volume of a three sphere here. And there's nothing here depending on the angles, just depends on the normal p. For the normal p, this is more like p cubed dp, this is a log p, so the whole thing is getting is a problem in the ultraviolet. If p goes to zero, it's fine because a is not zero. Even if a was zero, it's fine because p goes to zero. So the way to do this is that, so this is some function of a. If you differentiate to a enough, eventually it will converge. So I think the FDA, let's just call it a and I squared. That's the integral d4p, 2π/4, 1 over b squared plus a squared, plus a. Well, that still doesn't converge because that goes like p fourth over b squared. So the derivatives is minus the integral. Still doesn't converge because that goes like e fourth p over p to the fourth. That's only diverging logarithmically. So one more derivative will be fine. That one you can calculate. Sorry. That's going to be 2 e fourth p. That converges, and so that's just some power, that's a power of A. And let me just tell you the answer is. So what the idea is that you calculate what this is, and then you integrate it three times with like an A. And there'll be three integration constants in it from that. And those three integration constants are all going to be polynomials in A. And remember, A is really B plus or minus powers of field. And the integration constants you're going to get when you integrate with A are exactly the coefficients of the L to the fourth term, the L squared term, and the L independent term, which are things that you can normalize anyway. So the ambiguity in this integral, the divergent part, is occurring in specific kinds of interactions, which we'll identify in a second. But the rest of it is all completely determined. So the upshot is that you get that F is going to be 1 over. And it will be for what I'm writing down here is now you're actually one thing. So far I have a idea. But when I went from here, when I did this integral, I was implicitly thinking that A did not depend on P. So you remember what A was? A was this thing B plus or minus. This came from derivative potential. These are just powers. This is some function of the field. And so if the fields were position dependent, the background fields were position dependent, then this whole Fourier expansion thing wouldn't have diagonalized things so nicely as I'm trying to tell you here, because it wouldn't have been true that if I take a kinetic delta and I hit a if I have delta act on a plane wave, I won't get just plane wave back. I won't get, because if the background fields depend on position, what will happen is that the box will hit the background fields and I'll start getting things that are not just in the form of the eigenvalue equation I have. So my statement that a plane wave diagonalizes delta is true only if I specialize to background fields that are independent of position. Because in that case, the fields themselves are constants, so these potentials evaluated as the field and function fields are constants. These are just constants of some sort. So they're not playing any complicating at all the diagonalization in the position space. So as long as I'm specializing in constant fields, I can do all these integrals. So the statement would be that gamma, one loop, if gamma is equal to constant, and h is equal to constant, but any constant, that would be equal to 1/64π² interval, and one equals the semi intervals. Minus sign integral d4x times the constant. So it's contribution to the potential in the action. And that constant is sine It's b plus squared log b plus u squared b minus squared log b minus u squared plus quarter polynomial in h. And this is something which I'll never be able to determine because that's the thing that the those are the integration constants I get when I go I integrate back to get back from the third derivative. And those are things whose coefficients were divergent. If I did this interval, if I regulated this interval, I would have found divergent. Welcome back to that this afternoon. But mu is just an arbitrary thing with dimensions of mass. If you ask, does anything depend on mu? The answer is yes. If you change mu, what happens is that if I ask how this, if I change in mu, if I take delta mu goes to mu plus delta mu, then what happens is that I get a contribution which is going on b plus squared plus b minus squared. If you take the definition here, b plus squared plus b minus squared, it's not obvious from what I wrote here. I thought it was obvious, but it's not obvious. But the, what you find if you, when you take d and u of this is something which is a quarter polynomial in the L's nations. And so because we started with the polynomial which is originally quarter in the L's nations, because we started with a normalizable project, here the ambiguity in u is all things that are quarter polynomials in L and H, and those are all sort of things we couldn't determine anyway because they're divergent. So the mu dependence here can always be absorbed in mu dependence here. But all the stuff that's not ambiguous is in this logic. So this is the master formula I'm going to follow. But it does, but it's important that it's specialized to L and H constants. So what I'm imagining is that this one loop answer, in general, you could do a derivative expansion for it. So if we get done rewritten, if we write the gamma 1 loop as the integral of some effective potential for x, let me just write the e for x first. So there'd be a thing which is independent of derivatives plus things involving two derivatives, so we could have minus some matrix. Expansion out for this one loop effect potential, one loop effective action, one loop contribution to the one particle producible and one gap generator. The thing that has no derivatives is called the effective potential. Normally, expectation values of fields are expecting them to be independent of position because that minimizes their energy. So, this is normally the thing that's most interesting in trying to find the minimum effects of fields. And what I'm giving it here is an explicit expression here, an explicit expression for this potential. It has the required integral d for x. That's the volume of space that comes to you as a delta. That's the delta of zero momentum. It's the thing that in position space would have been an integral over all the volume. So that's the thing telling you the answer was extensive. The energy per unit volume is the thing that you calculate. And that's what this is. And then this stuff, we could calculate what we did. So you have to include the simplest way to do that would be to perturb and write the field thing background event with a small perturbation, which is in position and work to some fixed order in the derivative. So there's an extension of what I'm describing, which would give you the terms of the curve. So what I want to do is close the second out is to say, well, now we have a formal expression for the exponential. So we can at least focus on that. That's the one with the bellow, and ask, so what was it then supposed to do with the big H? Evaluate with this, together with the classical action, we're supposed to find the value of H as a function of L, which is stationary point. Plug that back in to the action, and in that way, calculate the one with the correction piece to the one with the particle. And you'll see that it has a a lot of similarities, but some differences from looking. So I'll do that example back to that.